threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
We're living in unusual times where the geopolitical map has been redrawn in the Middle East over the last 2 years, and even the experts inside the United States State Department, in the Pentagon, can't figure out what exactly is going on. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Before we get to our guest, just want to quick program note here. We're trying something new on A View from the Bunker. So this program not only is coming to you via the standard MP3 format. If you've been a longtime subscriber to the podcast, I appreciate that. But you'll also find this online now at YouTube. We're going to start putting these up online at YouTube with a little bit of video content. In future, we'll try to do more Skype video interviews with guests and make this a little more interesting. The podcast will continue. You'll always get the audio version, but look online. I've got a YouTube channel set up now, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, where A View from the Bunker will be posted going forward. We're going back and videoizing the older interviews, and those will be posted as they become available. And also got a playlist up there for my audio book, the novel The God Conspiracy, which was released through Patio Books back in 2009. We're going to make that available as an ongoing serial, released one part per week at YouTube. Again, the YouTube channel is youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Please go there and subscribe. And then every time we post a new interview or a new episode of The God Conspiracy, which will be spun out over a period of 6 months, you'll get an email. So now to our guest. He is a best-selling author of numerous books, and this is the fourth, essentially, of a four-part series. The previous books, Petrus Romanus, Exo Vaticana, and On the Path of the Immortals, the new book co-written with Tom Horn, The Final Roman Emperor, The Islamic Antichrist, and The Vatican's Last Crusade. And the newest member of the Skywatch TV squad, Chris Putnam. Chris, welcome.
Hey, Derek. It's great to be on View with the Bunker with you.
Well, this, I think, is the first interview we've done face-to-face. Well, aside from the interviews at some of the prophecy conferences, but this is the first time we can actually sit down across the table. And Well, it's been a long journey getting here. I mean, and you've got the scars to prove it.
No doubt. Yeah.
How's your finger?
Escaping cat out the door, slamming the door on my finger. And so I'm still dealing with a little pain there, and I am missing fingernail. If anybody knows what that's like, We'll just leave that one alone for now.
Yeah. Well, Sam Doxson says it just proves that he's been right all along. Cats are evil. But no, we're glad you and Shelley are here. And then, of course, you got here and immediately get sick to the point where, we had people go over to your house and pound on the door and nobody answered. And it's like, okay, what's going on?
Yeah.
Lord, intercede here. Yeah. So,
there's something in the water, I think.
Well, listen, we're happy to be on a well, let's put it that way. The final Roman Emperor, the Islamic Antichrist, the Vatican's Last Crusade, this is a topic that's been of real interest here, because not only does it pick up the threads from the previous books about the prophecy of the popes and what is the Roman Catholic Church's interest in what they perceive to be coming from outer space and how are they involved in the world geopolitically. But it also, you and Tom tackled what's going on with the Islamic State and ISIS, mm-hmm. and drew upon the work of fellows become a friend, Dr. Timothy Furnish, who is an expert in Islamic history and Islamic eschatology, mm-hmm. which until the Islamic State came along, I had no real clue about. It dawned on me that everything I thought I knew about Islamic eschatology had been absorbed from conservative commentators like Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. Well, not O'Reilly so much anymore, but people like that who don't, in thinking back on what I'd heard from those commentators, basically conservative radio talk show hosts, they didn't have a clue. They didn't know the difference between Sunni and Shia because they were conflating the two and getting it all wrong.
And most people do. And I had kind of done the same sort of thing. And Islam wasn't something that I spent a lot of time with as an apologist ever in the past. To me, there was a lot of people doing that, and I just didn't see that as my calling,
right.
really. So I didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. When I was in seminary, we covered it, and I'm familiar with all the basics and, what they believe and whatnot. But it just wasn't something I was terribly interested in for me, it's so obviously false.
Yeah, yeah.
That it just seemed like a waste of time.
Well, just to give you an idea, I still find myself fighting that sort of preconception.
Uh-huh.
My presentation for July that I'm working on is dealing with cosmic mountains, the cosmic mountain thing. And some of your work has been helpful in that because it helped open my eyes when you wrote about the cosmic mountain and how Armageddon will be fought at the Har Moed, which is the Mount of Assembly. And, of course, that's Mike Heiser has done.
And that's where I learned it.
Exactly. Right, yeah, right. Credit where it's due. And so I thought, okay, let's divide history up into eras that are in which the key event that kind of turned history on a spiritual level,
mm-hmm.
Focused on something that happened on a particular mountain. So what are the cosmic mountains that are important through history? You've got Eden, obviously. Mm-hmm. Then you've got Mount Hermon, mm-hmm. for a couple of reasons. Not only was that where the Watchers descended, it was also, according to a scholar who's done work on this, about 40 years ago, a guy named Edward Lipinski identified Mount Hermon as the holy mountain of El, the Canaanite god. And, of course, his name became sort of a generic term for God in the Old Testament, at least the older parts of the Old Testament. Elyon, Elohim. Mm-hmm. That all comes
El
from
Shaddai.
El Shaddai.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you got Mount Hermon, of course. Then you got
Sinai.
You've got Babel, which was an artificial mountain, but still significant. You've got Mount Zophon in northern Syria, which mm-hmm. was the holy mountain of Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got Zion, of course, which is where the final battle will be fought. But I had completely left out, and I had to go back and rejigger the presentation, because there's another holy mountain that's led to like over a billion people around the world being enslaved to a false god, and that is Mount Jira' al-Nur, or the Mount of Enlightenment at Mecca,
mm-hmm.
where Muhammad allegedly received his instructions from Gabriel.
Right.
So, I mean, but again, it was because, and all of that to say, I understand where you're coming from when you think, okay, Islam is so obviously false, why should we even deal with it?
Well, of course you need to deal with it because so many people do believe it.
And, yes, exactly.
You know, and the thing is that when I was a child, two of my best friends were Muslims. And I didn't think a thing of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was long before 9/11. You know, right, I was a little kid. And I just thought they had a different Bible than we did. And it was basically the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. and I didn't think anything of it. And no one thought of Muslims as violent or dangerous. I mean, I knew there was a war in Lebanon at that time. I remember watching it on TV and things like that. But it just didn't occur to me. I just mm-hmm. was not aware of Jewish history or any of that stuff. I really wasn't a Christian.
Right.
And he was my best friend. And Waleed, you mm-hmm. know, was one of my best friends, and he's an Olympic athlete now. He's actually an Olympic coach in Bermuda, but one of my best friends growing up. And I had no idea what it meant that he was a Muslim. It never even occurred to me that we were any different.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I didn't have anything against him or anything that he believed. I just didn't even understand it.
Right.
And, you know, that's basically, it was just ignorant. And, you know, as I became a Christian and got educated and went to seminary and started studying apologetics, I found out, wait a minute.
And
we're talking about something that comes along 600 years after Jesus. Mm-hmm. All right. And it's so derivative of the New Testament that it's blatantly obvious to me that most of it's plagiarized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you take the Old Testament and then you switch Abraham and Ishmael. I mean, it's just so blatantly obvious that they switched it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no old manuscript has Ishmael as the son of promise. It doesn't even make sense because it wasn't even miraculous that Ishmael was born. He was the son of the slave.
Right.
I mean, and that was a compromise. And so obviously he couldn't be the son of promise. It doesn't even make sense. I mean, the son of promise was a miracle because Sarah was so old she couldn't have a child. That's why it was a promise.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't even make sense that Ishmael could be the son of promise. What kind of promise is that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Hagar was young.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't, it's so incoherent that it almost seemed ridiculous, but a lot of Muslims believe it and they're not bad people. And there's a lot of Muslims that are good people. And like my friends were good people. I mean, they were my best friends when I was growing up, and boy, he's a great athlete. I mean, and it's like, you know, I just didn't know. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of people like that. And, you know, I guess, you're kind of indoctrinated into something like that when you're young. You just don't really question it.
Right.
And maybe some of them do when they get older and they kind of fall away, like a lot of Christians do.
Right.
And so I don't know if he's a practicing Muslim now. I mean, I haven't really kept up with it. He lives in Bermuda now. So, but.
Well, one of the things that Dr. Furnish points out, and he made that point again this week on Skywatch TV, is that American politicians, Western politicians in general, have a tendency to try to marginalize the groups like the Islamic State, like Jamaat al-Nusra and other violent Islamic groups, and call them radical Islam,
right?
Saying that this is a bastardized strain of Islam. They have hijacked the religion. And what Dr. Furnish points out, and others like him, is no, this is not That's radical not. Islam. This is mainstream Islam. This is a pure Islam. Form of Islam.
Wahhabi Islam, right?
Salafist, actually. Well, I mean, there's a difference between Wahhabism and Salafist. Salafists consider Wahhabi an insult.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, because the Wahhabis are tied to the House of Saud.
Okay.
So Salafists are...
But the general practice is the same as the Saudi Arabians, right? The beliefs.
More or less, right. They're taking it back to the Quran. They're partying like it's, $6.99. It's essentially.
Exactly.
And that's what it comes down to. They're taking it back to its origins and trying to live a purer form of Islam. And our conversation earlier this week was about a group called Tablighi Jamaat, which is based out of India.
Okay.
Which was linked to that mosque in Orlando where the kid, who shot up the nightclub attended. And it purports to be a less violent strain of Islam. But the problem, according to Dr. Furnish, is that you get people who get into the Quran and begin reading about the life of Muhammad and want to emulate Muhammad.
He's violent.
Who waged war, had multiple wives, including one who was 6 years old. And you can't whitewash that stuff.
And I mean, I think that speaks for itself. Let's compare two religions. Compare Jesus and Muhammad.
Exactly.
And there's no comparison.
Right, right. And that's the thing that just drives me nuts about progressives, who will look at Christians and still conclude that Christians are a greater threat to their livelihood and their ability to live peaceable lives the way they choose than Muslims. Look, Jesus said to the disciples, go out and preach, and if a town won't receive you, shake the dust from your sandals and move on. Don't come back and burn and pillage.
Well, I wouldn't call Jesus a pacifist, but at the same time, he wasn't violent.
But he's reserving the sword for himself.
Right.
When he comes back, he's coming back to, kick and chew bubble gum, and he's going to be all out of bubble gum.
Right. He did fashion a whip, and, when people say, what would Jesus do? Keep in mind, he did fashion a whip and chase everybody out of the mosque, out of the temple.
Right, out of his father's house. Yeah.
So that is one of the options. What would Jesus do?
And just a quick rabbit trail, because there are a lot of stories coming out of Jerusalem and Israel lately about the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox rabbis who are seeing all kinds of signs that the
Messiah
is
back.
One even said this past week, Messiah is here. And, Rabbi Yehuda Glick, who's a big activist for the Temple Mount and the rebuilding of the Third Temple, just got named a member of Knesset. So, and there was some evidence, and I wrote about this in the book I Predict, that the Netanyahu administration is very quietly on the QT funding groups that are supporting the building of the Third Temple.
It's coming.
Yeah. The thing is, they want to make sure the Ark is part of it, but Jesus still called Herod's temple my father's house, and the Ark was not in that temple. They don't need the Ark. And actually, they don't need the temple, because the Ark was housed in the tabernacle, a tent, for hundreds and hundreds of years before
Bethel.
So, anyway, getting back to your book. what is this clash of civilizations that's coming? What does the church see coming? The Roman Catholic Church, that is.
Uh-huh.
And how is this going to lead to confrontation between them and violent Islam?
Well, Tom Horn first approached me, with working on this project. I mean, we were looking at, there's a lot of people talking about an Islamic Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very popular book by Richardson. Mm-hmm. And he, that's not that's a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a theological argument. Okay. And I wouldn't agree with many of his biblical interpretations in there, especially like the statue in Daniel, with that being the king of Avisdom, with the ten toes.
Yeah.
That just doesn't really wash with me. But I don't see that. But
I know Chris White has written a book that specifically refuted it.
I quoted that within my book as well.
Okay.
I read Chris's book.
Yeah,
Chris is a good friend.
Yeah, False Christ is the name of that book if you want to look that up.
Yeah, I would give Chris some of the credit for some of the work that, it's in here. And I footnote Chris in this book. Chris got it from, other people too. And there's a scholar that I quote that's actually over in Europe, and he's written several papers on this idea of the final Roman emperor. He's cited in the book, and his paper is actually available at academia.edu.
I love that website. I have downloaded so many papers from that website. I mean, you really need to look up that website, academia.edu, because you can find
it. I have papers on there.
Yeah. I've got one.
Okay.
I wrote it for a project that never came to be. It's on how the Freemasons venerate Nimrod.
Okay,
so,
there you go.
That was my only effort.
And, yeah, so you can find all my sources. Or, I mean, they're all footnoted, and, you know, and Furnish is a big one. I read Furnish's book, Holy Wars.
Yeah, that's the big scholarly one that was his doctoral thesis, dissertation.
I went through that whole thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's huge differences between Sunni and Shia. And, you know, a lot of the prophecy people have spent an inordinate amount of time, I think, on Shia. Iran. And Iran's scary.
Yeah.
And they're working on nuclear weapons. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. And so we're really worried about that because they've threatened Israel. They've threatened the United States openly. You know, death to the United States. Yeah, they've said that. And so, you know, that's a good reason to take it seriously. But that said, Dr. Furnish talks about something called Mahdism, or I don't know how he pronounces it.
With kind of a broader A, calls it Mahdi.
Mahdism or something.
Mahdism.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I'm not an Arabic speaker. But
he is, so I'll trust him.
Right. Yeah. I'm not pronouncing it right, but I call him the Mahdi, Mahdism, but I'm not saying modest.
Yes.
Modest. When I say that, I'm not saying you're humble.
Yeah.
I'm talking about someone who believes in the Mahdi, who is a human savior in Islam. Mm-hmm. He's a human figure who will come and establish a worldwide caliphate. Basically, meaning a caliph is like the pope of Muslims. Mm-hmm. He's like the Islamic Pope, basically. Now they have caliphs, but they don't really have a worldwide caliph.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's what Baghdadi's claim right now is, that he is now the new worldwide caliph, but the Saudi Arabians aren't going to accept that.
No.
And neither are the Iranians, because they're Shia. And, you know, the Saudi Arabians are basically the same form of Islam, basically, but they're not going to, they think that the Islamic State, they've even called it a Mossad counteroperation to make Islam look bad.
Yeah.
And that's what they've labeled it. They've even said that Baghdadi was a Mossad agent.
They're very concerned about the Islamic State. They built a high-tech border fence along the border between Saudi Arabia and Anwar province in Iraq to try to keep the Islamic State out.
The Islamic State has the goal of taking over Mecca.
Avi Lipkin makes a really good point. He says that in his opinion, Saudi Arabia has more to worry about from the Islamic State than Israel.
They do.
Yeah.
They actually do. And there's prophecies in the Hadith about the destruction of Mecca.
Ah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mecca's not supposed to last.
Yeah. You know, and that's really interesting that when you look at, and I touched on this, I was honored to contribute a chapter to this book, and I touched on it in the chapter that in Islamic eschatology, Jerusalem and Damascus are more important than Mecca or Medina.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mecca's history. If you read the Hadith, it's going to go away. Jerusalem is much more important.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's interesting to me, I mean, and just a little groundwork, you know, before we get any further in, you know, the thing that this book has is we're building on this basis of Petrus Romanus, where we started with this idea where we kind of put forth a hypothesis that, you know, the next pope could be the false prophet, a mm-hmm. biblical prophecy. Now, you know, we're not saying that we know that with authority. We've never, you know, claimed to know that with any kind of authority. But every speculation that we put in that book, Pope Francis has almost been over backwards to fulfill it. And I can't tell you why exactly, other than it hasn't been falsified. I'm not saying he's the man, but I can't say he's not.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing that I wrote in that book is false. I mean, there's nothing that I can find in there that I speculated that is wrong. He's just fallen right into the mold. And that doesn't mean he is, but it's easy to find confirmations of theories,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
you really try to falsify them. But none of the things that we said have been falsified. So it's still on track. It could still be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I said in this book. I'm not saying that we know he's the guy, but we don't know that he's not either. You know, and the thing is he is articulating language that's directly from Thomas Aquinas on the just war policy of mm-hmm. the Roman Catholic Church. And the terms that he's throwing out in the media, just war, unjust aggressor, mm-hmm. you know, these kinds of terminology are the Catholic policy of what makes a just war. Mm-hmm. And he's calling for a just war to stop ISIS. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt about that. We have a Pope who's meeting with Obama, who's meeting with the United Nations, calling for the United Nations to stop ISIS. And he's saying, not just one country can do this, kind of taking a shot at the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be the United Nations. And then what is this? Globalism. You know, the whole, ever since 9/11, we've had this kind of conspiracy world where we think we're giving up our rights to go into this totalitarian state. And it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, the Patriot Act. They're reading emails now. They don't have to have a search warrant to, you know, invade your privacy hardly.
In fact, even this week, the Senate is considering an amendment to a bill that would give the FBI greater power to access internet and phone records without a warrant.
Right.
And that they couldn't get gun control. They rejected four gun control measures, two from Republicans, two from Democrats, after the Orlando shooting.
Right.
But this is coming through, where the FBI is going to have greater surveillance powers, actually spying powers. They can basically spy on our stuff without a warrant.
They're doing it.
Yeah, and they've been doing it since 9/11, but now in reaction to Orlando, they're going to get even greater latitude.
So we see all that.
Right.
And then we see this huge push toward globalism.
Right.
And a global security force.
Right.
And, you know, you read the prophecies in the book of Revelation, we talk about one man is given power over every nation, tongue, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah.
And this is the Antichrist, right? So I'm not saying that he's here, but I'm saying all the pieces are falling in place very neatly for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this surveillance state that we're living in is increasing and it's becoming tighter.
Right.
And, you know, when you have a Pope calling for an international army to stop a terrorist organization, people are scared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to get searched to get on planes, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's scared. So they're willing to give up rights. And now the Pope's saying we need an international army to stop ISIS. I mean, it's like falling in place.
Yeah. And of course, ISIS is happy to rise to the bait because their prophecy, or the Hadiths, prophesy a coming conflict, a cataclysmic climactic battle against Rome.
The Crusaders?
The Crusaders, yeah. Christendom, if you will, at a place called Dabiq, which is north of Aleppo. And interestingly, even though when you look at a map of the territory that the Islamic State holds in Syria, they've just got like a little finger of territory north of Aleppo, but they specifically went and mounted a campaign in 2014 to take that village. It has no strategic
just
importance.
Just for the prophecy.
Yeah. Interestingly, though, when you look at that that hadith, it is either Dabiq or a certain valley.
It could be another place.
Yeah. In North, but the interesting part, that valley, which is near
Aleppo?
No, it's near, where was it? Antioch.
Okay.
Which is now in Turkey.
Right.
Antakya. But that valley is like, if I remember correctly, west of Antioch, between there and a mountain called Jebel al-Akra, which is Mount Zafan.
Oh, great.
The mountain of Baal. So it's like, coincidence?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's a lot of supernatural overtones, aren't there?
Yes. There was a prophecy, and I just want to touch on this because this, I know, is one that's been a favorite of conspiracy theorists on the web for quite some time. You devoted a chapter to Petrus Romanus, Albert Pike, the Islamic State, and Armageddon.
Right.
And this is the three world wars prophecy, supposedly, written by, was it Mazzini wrote it to Albert Pike?
Right. An Italian Freemason wrote it to Albert Pike, where they're predicting, we're going to use three world wars to engineer toward our future globalist world government, right?
Right.
And it seems to describe World War One and Two in great detail, very accurately, mm-hmm. right? And it's very controversial. Now, I think some of your friends at, what is it, the Conspiracy Archive?
Yeah, yeah.
They have a really good debunking of it there.
Right.
And it seems authoritative, and I read it. And it's pretty good. What they're showing is that there was a anti-Catholic writer who kind of like overblew everything. And
this was the name. This was Carr.
William Guy Carr was the guy that actually promoted it as a real prophecy.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. And he has a book called Pawns in the Game. You can even download an MP3 of him giving a talk. And I think I have a link footnoted in the book where you can download that MP3 and listen to him talk about it.
Okay.
Now, he firmly believed it. Now, he might have been a little naive, and I think his research probably was a little lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the 19th century, a lot of people would do polemics. And so this guy was making fun of Catholics and Freemasons,
mm-hmm.
and he blew the whole thing up into this huge drama.
Yeah.
And he made it where, you know, the Freemasons were trying to start this war, this whole thing. And, you know, so it becomes really unbelievable and you think it's all just manufactured. The problem is I found a book from 1930 by a Catholic priest. Now, the foreword to the book is written by the Pope. Okay. So we're not talking about just some
fringe
renegade Catholic priest, right? This is a real book and I have that book and I think it's on the DVD that we give away as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, he saw the letter, okay, that we're talking about and wrote about it and mentioned it.
Oh, and okay.
So it's not just something that this guy made up. It's based on something real. And no one's ever really had the real letter.
Mm-hmm.
And we just know that William Guy Carr probably blew it out of the water a little bit. He maybe exaggerated some or took this other guy's, polemic thing too seriously. But this Catholic priest that wrote this other book, he saw it, and the part he quoted, gosh, it sounded so much like what happened around 2006. He said, once we establish communism and, you know, people are starting to doubt their faith and stuff, we're going to unleash the atheists, and then they're just going to tear up everything, and mm-hmm. everybody's going to lose their faith. And boy, that just sounded like Hitchens, Dawkins, the whole career, you know?
although that's kind of hit a wall. I don't think those...
Yeah, those guys are kind of fading now.
Yeah, the neo-atheists. Yeah, yeah.
But it did sound like that at the time, when I read it. And I was like, these are the atheists he means. Yeah, I was like, there it is. Yeah. And I don't know if that's the case either, but, atheism did kind of get a surge right there. And I don't know, but he saw a letter and it did talk about some of this stuff. So it's not completely fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that it's completely accurate that about the three world wars, but I'm saying it's not debunked either.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know the level of detail that we can ascribe to it, but the quote from this Catholic priest, I think is legitimate. And he saw this letter. Now,
and again, it was pre-World War II.
It was pre-World War II, meaning it described a conflict between Zionists and the Germans. Okay. And that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And now, was that engineered? Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that letter's true, it's hard to believe, but I don't know. I mean, Zionism is a legitimate movement for the Jews to go back to their home. It's mm-hmm. not, people have turned it into this huge conspiracy where the Jews want to control the world and all this. Nonsense. I mean, there might be some that would do, but so there's lots of, Italians that want to do that too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a racist thing. It's, it's just a power thing. It's a political thing. And it's not based on being Jewish. It's not based on being anything other than political and, you know, wanting power. That's the common desire.
Yeah. And there are some Christians who will say that the modern state of Israel cannot refer to the restoration of the Jews to their homeland because it was not – because these people are clearly not godly. It was a Freemasonic plot that got them – look, if God can use Nebuchadnezzar and other pagan kings to achieve his ends, he can use Freemasons or whoever else he chooses. The fact is that the Bible prophesied that they would return to their homeland, and here they are.
Well, Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who's a Jewish theologian, Messianic scholar, he's mm-hmm. a Christian as well, a PhD, legitimate PhD.
Yeah. Studies eschatology.
And I've got his book, Israelology, where he goes into great detail about biblical prophecies about the return of the Jewish people to the homeland.
Mm-hmm.
I think he argues effectively that there is a two-stage return, and the first stage is in unbelief, and you see that in Ezekiel.
Sure.
And so, I mean, I think what we're seeing now is the return in unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
You have secular Jews. Most of them are secular. There's atheism. You can go to synagogue and be an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that. You can be an atheist rabbi, I think, even.
In some
branches of Judaism.
We see a lot of atheist pastors in the pulpit, too.
Yeah, there really
are. Sharon talks about a church that she attended back in Lincoln, Nebraska, where she was a member of a church that had just an amazing choir. A lot of music students from University of Nebraska Lincoln were members of the church.
And they don't even believe.
Yeah, one Sunday morning, the pastor was talking on Easter Sunday.
Right.
Didn't mention the resurrection on Easter Sunday. And she went up to him afterward and asked why. He says, I just can't get my head around the whole resurrection thing. I just can't believe that actually happened.
Wow. Yeah, what's the point?
What's the point? Yeah.
Yeah, and what's the gospel then?
Yeah.
if Jesus didn't die, then
it's nothing more than doing.
I guess we're dead in our sins.
Yeah, it's nothing more than being nice to other people.
Yeah.
In which case, you know, we might as well just, you know, worship Dr. Phil.
You could be a Freemason then. I mean, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, make another man.
Yeah, it becomes just a social club.
Well, but you know, politics, mm-hmm. you know, is obviously, you know, played a role in the restoration of Israel or the recreation of Israel as a state. But
World War II, though, I mean, the Holocaust. It was, right. We needed somewhere to put them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe today, if I was a Jew, I would, you know, we'd be making aliyah because let's go where there are other people like us who agree that our interests are the official policy of the state,
right,
instead of trying to work within another state to, you know, achieve our own ends.
And we have to keep in mind, I mean, a lot of the liberals who are against Zionism supposedly forget that the United Nations approved all of this.
Exactly.
And they gave them that land.
Right.
And it was British, under British control.
Right.
They gave them that land. I mean, the Jews didn't steal it.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't run, this was all done legally.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened is the day they declared statehood is all their neighbors attacked them.
Right.
And so, and that is why we have Palestinian refugees, because they are refugees of war that they started.
Yeah.
The Jews didn't start that war. And they were trying to be peaceful with them.
Almost 70 years ago, they're what, third generation refugees now living
in the Arab nations will not allow them to go into their own country
and settle. Right.
Right.
Because they're a useful political pawn.
They're using them as a tool. Yeah.
Well, but you also, in this chapter, you talk about the possibility of a political pawn, William Guy Carr writing that Satan has his agentur within the hierarchy of Roman Catholicism, and then speculating that based on the biography of the recently retired Cardinal Godfrey Danneels of Belgium,
right,
that Pope Benedict was pushed out by a cabal within the Vatican.
He wrote that.
Yeah.
And
he actually called it a mafia club.
He did.
Bore the name of St. Gallen. I talked about this in one of the Daily Updates months ago. Uh-huh. But it's interesting that now a popular Catholic blogger by the name of Anne Barnhart,
uh-huh,
earlier this week said she's come to the conclusion that that Pope Francis should still be Cardinal Bergoglio. And she says he's not.
He's an anti-pope.
Yeah, she's declared him an anti-pope. I don't know if you saw that article, but
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I didn't read the whole thing. I started reading it the other day and I said, I got to send this to Chris. But yes, she is a very popular blogger on issues of faith, especially related to Roman Catholicism.
She would be the first to say it. I mean, a lot of people are saying it.
But she's fairly mainstream. There are people out there like, Michael, the fellow who does the Roman Catholic online television station.
Oh, yeah.
Whose name I can't remember.
ETWN or whatever?
No. No, he's got his own thing where it's a subscription-only web-based Michael. And he's a very conservative Catholic, and he's very, very critical of the church.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, there are people who have been making this claim, but she's relatively mainstream, as I understand
it. Well, then you have the whole set of Vaticanists that think that the papal seat's been empty since, what, 62 or 58, depending on which one they – yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I tried to interview a guy that I know you've had some contact with as well, and because I've talked to you, he wouldn't come on A View from the Bunker.
Yeah,
because
he's a little bit out there. Yeah. I don't even know if he qualifies. But
yeah,
there's a lot of Catholics that aren't happy with Pope Francis because he's not following Catholic doctrine whatsoever. In fact, he makes, like, really crazy statements like, I'm not really sure if this is a heresy or not, but I'm going to just throw it out of there. You know, it's like, wait a minute. You're the vicar of Christ, supposedly, and you're not sure if it's a heresy? Really? I thought you were the Pope. It's like, what do you think of homosexual priests? Who am I to judge? The Pope?
I mean, yeah, really? Yeah.
Seriously? I don't know where he's coming from. He tries to put off this humble thing, but it's
and that's why it's so popular, because he's saying things like that. He's popular with secularists.
He's popular with people that don't believe anything.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
So what is the context then? You cite a quote from St. Francis of Assisi, our Lord Jesus Christ will send them not a true pastor, but a destroyer.
That's
the title of the chapter, Pope Francis Destroyer. What is...
That chapter is actually pretty shocking. I did not know how bad it was going to be until I really did that research. I knew Pope Francis was saying these things like, who am I to judge? And he got into it with an atheist on the Italian paper. Atheists please God if they obey their conscience. He said that. And, you know, that's not what the Bible says.
That's what the Bible says.
Without faith, you cannot please God.
Right.
That's a direct quote from the Bible.
Right.
And he's telling an atheist, just obey your conscience and you please God. I mean, yeah. Where does he get this from? I mean, he's supposed to be instead of Christ. That's what vicar means. Mm-hmm. You know, it means instead of or against. I mean, I think they mean instead of, in place of Christ. You know, and that's the way they're trying to say that.
Sadly, he's got some counterparts on the Protestant side of the aisle, and we can talk a little bit later about some of the overtures that those groups have been making to one another. But the idea that tradition or new revelation supplants and supersedes what's in the Bible.
Right. Well, that's just insane, though, because Jesus said some of these things that he's supplanting. You know. Well,
I know.
It's just you can't do that.
Yeah.
So we have Francis, you know, saying these things, and. Obviously, they are so inconsistent with even Catholic theology. It's just ridiculous, you know. And so what do you do with all that? Well, you know, of course, when he was elected, we weren't looking for some guy named Bergoglio, exactly. We were, you know, a lot of people thought he would be named Peter. I never really thought that because Peter's a symbolic name based on their idea that they're all apostolically succeeded from the Apostle Peter, which is kind of silly anyway, because I don't think was the whole point Jesus was making in Caesarea Philippi when he said,
right.
Upon this rock. Yeah, rock is the word Petra in Greek, but it's actually, there's a gender difference in rock and the name Peter, and the referent would not be, it didn't match. Okay. So it doesn't even work grammatically.
So at Caesarea Philippi, you were at the base of Mount Hermon.
Right.
So is it possible?
It was probably the real rock.
Yeah.
And Jud Burton's book, Interview with a Giant, probably makes a much better argument about what rock that was. And it was the one facing the Grotto of Pan, which was actually what they thought were the gates of hell.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's a much more accurate piece of exegesis than what the Catholics are offering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting because we've got this Pope who is as near as we can tell taking the church in a direction different from his predecessors.
He's a liberal. I mean, obviously, he's a Jesuit, first Jesuit Pope ever.
Yeah.
Okay, we have Malachi Martin writing 1990 or so. His first book, The Jesuits. Mm-hmm. First line of the book. There's a war between the Jesuit order and the papacy. Mm-hmm. That was the first line in the book. Okay. All right. We have the first Jesuit pope. Who won the war?
Yeah.
Right? That's the end of the war, right?
Sharon's been telling me for months that I need to read that book, and I just haven't found the time.
I've got it if you want it.
Well, we've got it in a Kindle version,
okay.
Which is good when you get older. You can, you know, resize the font. And
right.
I've got
the hardback.
The Kindle version's easier to read in bed at night without waking up your wife.
I
know. Malachi Martin was an interesting fellow. He
wasn't afraid to talk. And he got a release from his vows of silence brought by Pope John Paul III?
Don't know.
Paul VI, I think, wrote him a letter saying that he could talk.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And he did.
I was wondering about that, though, because if Martin was Jesuit, how do we know that what he wasn't putting
out
there?
He was released, there? Yeah.
Okay.
He was controversial. Some people say that he maybe carried on with a woman. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was one of the accusations.
He was very outspoken. He called it, the super force. He called it a satanic force. In fact, in his novel, Windswept House.
He called it the Roman Phalanx.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I quit that, both of those books. He called that book Faction, all right? Meaning it was fiction, but it was based on facts, okay?
And in the opening chapter, the prologue, he described a satanic ritual conducted over the telephone to a spot in the Vatican.
Charleston, South Carolina.
Which was the site of the
during
first...
the ordination of the Vatican II Pope. Pope Paul VI.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And supposedly somewhere in Charleston, South Carolina, they were doing sex magic as he was elected to make him an instrument of Lucifer, the papacy, office of the papacy.
Yeah.
That was the purpose of the ritual. Okay? It's called the Parallel Enthronement Ceremony. Mm-hmm. It happened in 1962. So supposedly every pope after that has been the Parallel Enthronement of Lucifer.
Hmm.
That's what that ritual was for. Now, I'm not saying that that's true, but that's what they meant it to be, and they did it, okay? And it involved the repeated rape of a young girl in Charleston, All right.
Yeah.
So it's not a pretty thing.
And again, Charleston being on the 33rd parallel and the site of the first Freemasonic Lodge.
It's where Albert Pike founded Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Yeah. And I visited there. And, yeah. and I, it's true. It's, you know, very sick and, you know, diabolic if it's true. You know, does that kind of ritual magic work? Well, the Catholics think it does. That's mm-hmm. what their whole sacramental system is about. Mm-hmm. And the Freemasons obviously do. They spend an inordinate amount of time doing rituals. Hopefully they don't think they're wasting their time, I don't guess. so, I mean, they do all that for something. And, you know, the purpose of this one was to transform the office of the papacy into the instrument of Lucifer. That is exactly what he wrote. And that was not in the fiction book. That is in the book, The Keys of This Blood, yeah. a nonfiction book.
Yeah, which okay. is on the bookshelf back in my office there.
That one too. Yeah. yeah. And I quote both. But the nonfiction one is the more, it has the same details as the fiction one. So, mm. I mean, and, you know, it doesn't name. Too many names, but you could figure out some of the players.
Yeah, yeah. Just as a quick observation, it's amazing to me that you can write things like this in books like this and Exo Vaticana and Petrus Romanus and still be called a Jesuit coadjutor.
It's crazy.
By some of your critics.
I know. If they read Petrus Romanus, what I wrote about Catholic theology, they would change their mind quickly. They just haven't read my work.
Yeah. yeah. Well, the very fact that you're talking about Catholics means you are pro-Catholic.
I know. It's crazy, though, because I go through all the reasons why the sacramental system's wrong. And, you know, Peter's not the first pope. I give tons of evidence that he was actually buried in Jerusalem. I mean, I go to great lengths to debunk Catholicism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for anyone to call me a Jesuit, they just are ignorant.
Yeah. yeah. I remember Tom Horn telling me privately after that first book, he said, I wish I'd read the chapters that Chris sent me a little more closely because some of that language is a little bit
harsh.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what.
It's not that he disagreed with the point. It's just
right.
He was trying to be a little more diplomatic.
I probably offended some Catholics, but I'll tell you the what. Yeah. I offended one at my church and he quit coming. And his family was Catholic and he wasn't anymore, but he still was very sympathetic to it. But here's what happened. I mean, the guy who is now the head pastor at the church I went to is a big church. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to use his name right now, but, you know, guy I respected a lot. He was instrumental in me learning a lot about the Bible, you know, as a young Christian. You know, really solid pastor. He's now the lead pastor. He took over. I mean, they gave him the job. That's mm-hmm. how good he was. You know, out of like 10 guys, and it was a big church, like 2,000 members. Mm-hmm. And now he's the head pastor. He just got that job last year. And I sent him. There's a book called The Faith of Millions. It's a Catholic apologetics book. Mm-hmm. So it's defense of Catholic theology. Okay, I quoted what the priest believes he's doing during the Mass. Mm-hmm. Okay, verbatim, and I sent that to him. I said, what do you think of this? He said, it makes me want to vomit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I put that in the book.
Yeah.
All right. And why? Here's what the priest, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it says he reaches up into heaven, grabs Jesus off his throne, snatches him off his throne, straps him to the altar, and sacrifices him for the sins of this week. That's the Mass.
Yeah.
The priest has the authority to snatch Jesus off his throne and re-kill him every week. That's what a Mass is. And if you don't find that disgusting, then I don't know if you really understand what the cross was. Because it says over and over in the book of Hebrews, he did this once for all.
Right, right.
Once.
Yeah.
The word once appears over and over and over. You don't have to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know where they get this idea, but it's a way to keep you on what I call a treadmill.
Yeah.
And I mean,
dependent on the church because
depending on the church.
Yeah, you have to keep coming back to get
you
your weekly dose of Jesus.
You have to keep coming back to get your sins forgiven.
Right.
And now the Bible says your sins are forgiven, past, future, and present. The ones you haven't even thought of yet are already forgiven.
Right.
Because the cross.
Right.
Not from the priest.
And of course, Paul makes it clear. I mean, we're saying this so that sin should abound, heaven forbid. That's not what he means.
That's not what he means.
Yeah, but that we are...
You're still covered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are no longer bound by the sacrificial system.
Right.
Which, by the way, not that I want to... I keep beating this drum and I can't help it. The Hebrew Roots movement is essentially wanting
to
go back to the same thing.
Yeah, they are. They are. And Martin Luther gets a lot of bad rap for saying this, but I have no problem saying it. He said, sin and sin boldly. He does. You're a sinner. Sin boldly. You're forgiven.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's good to sin, but he's saying it's already covered. And that's what he was trying to emphasize. Mm-hmm. He wasn't trying to say that it's okay to have sex and do all these crazy things that people try to make it out to be. Luther was very devout.
Yeah.
I mean, he was almost insanely devout, probably much more than most of these Hebrew roots people can even imagine. You know, it wasn't about that. He was just trying to make a theological point because the church really wants to enslave you to their system.
Yeah.
And that's what he was against because they were selling indulgences to get you out of purgatory, which doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I mean, literally pay money to get your dead relatives out of purgatory.
And that's never been officially renounced by the Roman Catholic Church.
They still do it.
Yeah.
They still do it. And it's camouflaged. You pay for a mass card to have a special mass. Okay. And same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a way of trying to buy somebody out of purgatory. And they're still doing it. You can get a plenary indulgence for following Pope Francis on Twitter, apparently. So, I mean, it's
really.
Yeah.
Well, I better sign up right now. So.
Yeah, that's true. When he was speaking down in South America, they offered a plenary indulgence if you listened to his talk and followed him on Twitter. And that was, yeah, you can get time off of purgatory for that.
Well, bringing this back around in the last 10 or 15 minutes here or so,
right.
to the clash of cultures that's coming between Rome, which is the largest nominally Christian denomination mm-hmm. on the planet.
Right.
And the Muslims, which, you know, Sunni Islam is not all of Islam, but it is the majority, about 80%.
Right.
And not all Sunnis agree with the Wahhabists and the Salafists.
Right.
But when you look at the Pew Research Center's surveys, and Dr. Furnish has done a really good job of summarizing this, the information is available in his books, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, and 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps. More than half of the Muslims in America would rather be governed by Sharia than by the U.S. legal code.
Sure.
And a majority of...
England's already accommodating that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, as we record this, they voted for Brexit. How about that? The vast majority of Muslims living in... And there's probably a connection here, although, you know, proximity does not equal causality, but the Muslims living in places where the American army has been active over the last 15 years, like Afghanistan and Iraq, particularly, but even in places like Jordan and Lebanon, the majority of Sunni Muslims expect to see the Mahdi return within their lifetime. So sometime in the next 40 years, say.
Right. And that makes them modest.
Yes, yes. but you've got a chapter here which is got another intriguing title. Thomas is nothing if not expert, brilliant at coming up with compelling book and chapter titles. The last Roman emperor becomes the Muslim's Mahdi. How does that happen when – credit where it's due. That's your title. How does that happen when you've got these what appear to be diametrically opposed worldviews?
Yeah. Well, okay. A little groundwork must be laid to explain that, but where does all this Islamic eschatology come from? Well, first, let's define Mahdism. Anybody never really got that. So the Mahdi is the savior character that all Muslims believe in.
And the Sunnis and the Shias have different...
They both believe in him, but it's different guy.
Completely different.
Right.
In fact, when the Sunni Mahdi appears, the Shias are likely to point to him and say, that's the Dajjal.
Right, right, right. So the Shias believe in this 12th Imam who was mysteriously occulted, is the word they like to use,
which
means hidden, or he disappeared, he was raptured, something.
He's hiding in a well.
He's underground in a cave or whatever. He vanished, and he was like the 12th successor from Muhammad, and he's supposed to come back. In the end times,
and that's why
he never died.
12er Shia.
He's immortal somehow, right?
Exactly. A supernatural character.
Right. And that's what they believe, and that's what most of our prophecy people talk about, because that's the popular Iranian kind of idea, right? But that's not what most Muslims believe.
No.
Most Muslims are Sunnis. Mm-hmm. Shias, minority. And they believe it's a human character who's going to be a world leader.
Like the Jewish concept of the Mashiach.
Yeah.
It's a human
character.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. The same sort of thing. And somebody like a Baghdadi could maybe qualify.
Right. And there have been a number of Mahdis throughout history that have emerged and led.
There have been several.
And that have led violent revolutions.
One of the best Islamic scholars in the United States, other than Furnish, is a guy named David Cook. And he has a whole book cataloging Mahdis throughout history. Recent history. I mean, who have committed all kinds of atrocities.
Right.
And because people believed he was the Mahdi.
Yeah.
And they followed him. I mean, in Africa especially, just all kinds of carnage. And they thought he was the Mahdi. And so, I mean, when people believe this, they're willing to do almost anything because right. it means the end times are here and mm-hmm. everything goes.
Yeah.
And when you have a crusade theory of war, which I have a chapter on theories of war, and this is what Joshua had in the Old Testament. So it's not alien to our Bible, but that means anything goes. Mm-hmm. You have a divine mandate to wipe out everything.
Yeah.
All right. And this is the way Muslims are functioning with these radicals. Okay. So there's no problem in slaughtering babies. There's no problem in slaughtering women and children.
Because it's all
innocent bystanders do not exist. They're not innocent. They're crusaders. Right. They're evil. I mean, you're fighting the devil. Is what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if they're supposedly innocent bystanders. There's no such thing as an innocent bystander in a crusade theory of war. And this is what the Catholics did when they took Jerusalem in the Crusades. Right. That's where the word crusade comes
from. Kill them all and God sort them out.
Yeah, that's basically the idea. And it's not the way we usually operate. That's not the Geneva Convention anyway, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the way we don't think that's ethical. That's where just war theory comes into play. And it's not a bad idea. I'm not really criticizing Thomas Aquinas too much. Some of those things are very nice. I'm glad that somebody thought of that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about how you conduct yourself in war. Do you want to use chemical weapons and indiscriminately kill children? I don't, you know,
right.
I don't even know if we should be using drones the way we are because they're very indiscriminate themselves. They do save lives as far as our soldiers, but they also kill a lot of innocent people too.
Right.
You know, and that's the problem.
Especially if some of these reports are correct that the CIA has been using the double tap method. You basically shoot it first and wait till the first responders arrive and then hit them again kill the ambulance drivers and the policemen and the firemen.
Right. Just kill them all and throw them out later.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's not really an ethical way to conduct warfare.
No.
I don't think. You really want to go after the enemy combatant, not his wife.
Right.
You know? This is a huge problem. But, you know, Muslims are operating from a crusade theory of war. What they call us crusaders, but actually the Catholics are trying to use a just war theory. It's actually reversed.
Yeah.
It really is reversed. They're the crusaders.
Right.
They really are.
Yeah.
The Muslims are the crusaders. If you go by what the word crusade means. So Sunnis see a human leader as this new mm-hmm. worldwide caliph, leader of all Islam, coming on the scene, and he's going to turn the world Muslim militarily, politically, the same way the Jews think the Messiah will.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Right.
The same way Catholics believe the great final Catholic emperor will. What am I talking about? Look into Catholic eschatology. Go to the EWTN, whatever Catholic network, and watch their eschatology show. They talk about this. They still believe it.
Really?
There is a belief that there's a great Catholic emperor. It used to be he was French, back when France was a world power, right?
Yeah.
And they thought, you know, like Charlemagne, the whole thing, right? The Holy Roman Empire,
mm-hmm.
they thought that was going to return. And where does that all come from? Well, there's this piece of pseudepigraphal literature, I call it. It's actually now called the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius or Methodius. I'm not really sure of the correct pronunciation on that, but I usually say Methodius, but I think Methodius might be right. Anyway, he was a church father in the 3rd century. This literature comes out 6th century. No scholar believes he wrote it now.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, they did. Because nobody really – there was no source criticism. There was no
right.
you know, no way
well,
to compare
and this. Our approach to Islam early on, it's like it doesn't matter if it's false or not. What matters is how many people believe it and how it affects
right.
their behavior.
Well, the thing is, this was a Christian piece of literature.
Right.
And it was called the Apocalypse of Methodius. He was a real church father. He did some really good work. I mean, he did some good things. But he didn't write this.
Yeah.
Because it predicts things that he had no knowledge of. I mean – in detail. It predicted the rise of Islam and all this stuff. And he wasn't thinking about Islam in 300. But this apocalypse does, you know, it catalogs a lot about Islam. And really, it was a polemic response to Islam. It was a way that Christians were trying to deal with it and explain it because they were really expecting Jesus to return. Mm-hmm. They're like, where is he?
So this was a 7th century book then.
Yeah. And it was popular in Syria. It's a Syriac. The earliest copies are in Syriac.
Because Syria has been, well, again, Syria in Islamic eschatology and Islamic history has always been far more important to their political success than Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. It was. And Damascus is where Paul converted. So it's also the early seat of Christianity.
Yeah.
So this is an early Christian popular work. Everybody on the street knew it about it, believed it. And it predicts a final Roman emperor who would Christianize the world. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus would return. Okay.
I see where you're going. So this final Roman emperor, of course, based on this pseudepigraphal prophecy of Pseudo-Methodius, will in turn actually be the Antichrist who will be
– well. Yeah, could yeah,
or at least a figure that will lead the world toward this.
Catholics still believe this
global system.
They morphed that into the great Catholic emperor. Okay, it turned into a French king.
Yeah,
all right, but it's still rampant within Roman Catholicism, and there's all these Catholic mystics throughout time who have confirmed it. Bartholomew, all these other guys, and I quote them in my book. I mean, there's plenty of Catholics that have said it over time, you know, famous ones, and I mean, lots of them, including popes.
I'm laughing because as you're talking, I'm realizing I'm going to have to revise my presentation again before.
Really?
Because I've got to include because this is significant.
Well, I'm going to talk about that too, probably in mine.
Yeah, well, I'm going to touch on it. And I'll cite your work on this, but because clearly this is a key thing. The whole point of my presentation is not so much the Holy Mountains, but on psyops.
Right.
Psyops. The enemy has been using psyops against mankind since the garden.
Absolutely.
And this is a key psyop. One of the key was
how do we get the whole world to fall for the Antichrist?
Exactly.
Right.
And presenting a conqueror that is I agree that
that's what Antichrist is.
Yeah. Right? The false Christ as Chris
He's
Wright.
He's the conqueror who supposedly brings peace to the world at first, right? That's what we always think. Okay, so this guy supposedly Christianizes the world. Okay, this is in the 7th century, right?
Yeah.
And so in Damascus, everybody believes all the Christians are talking about this great final and the Muslims, this is the time the Hadith are being composed.
Right.
The Hadith are, you know, hearsay sayings of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really heard. I mean, maybe some of them are genuine.
We don't know. But Islamic scholars,
they don't even know.
They disagree on which ones are authentic, which ones are not. Yeah, they rank them according to whether they're strong or weak.
And there's huge collections
of
them.
Disparity between Sunnis and Shias as to which hadiths are true.
Even within Sunnis, I mean, there's different collections.
Right.
And you know, it's not even clear which ones are which. I mean, within that, they debate it. Right?
It's a muddled mess.
You can't find a single source talking about a Mahdi before 700.
The Mahdi's not in the Quran.
He's not in the Quran. The only thing the Quran says about eschatology is the Day of Judgment.
Yeah.
And
the return of Isa, their Jesus, is in the Quran, but not, you know, the Mahdi
but
was in
judge
later.
The world, basically. Right. And it's the same as the book of Revelation, except there's not two resurrections, there's one.
Yeah.
And it looks plagiarized.
And so the Mahdi was plagiarized
from the apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius, basically.
So basically, they took the concept.
The Christians all had this great king coming. What are we going to do about that? Oh, we'll have a Muslim version.
Uh-huh.
And so the Hadith writers, as a polemic, came up with the Mahdi as the counterpart to the final Roman emperor.
Yeah.
Okay. It's really obvious.
Yeah. and this is the thing that
– Mahdi probably never – Muhammad probably never even talked about a Mahdi.
No, probably not. This – like I said, I've got to revise my presentation because I've done a lot of work and research into others who've actually done the work. Let me put it that way, because a lot of the source information comes from people like Al Dager, Holly Pivick, and some of the online discernment ministries that have dug into the Dominionist movement, which is a Protestant Christian
same kind
movement,
of thing.
But it's the same kind of thing. But what's really been intriguing is that over the last couple of years, and I talked about this in my presentation in 2014, when Pope Francis met with a number of
Kenneth Copeland,
Kenneth and Gloria Copeland, John Robison, John Arnott, charismatic bishop who was part of the Anglican Convention, but was not an Anglican. He was from South Africa. Bishop Tony Palmer.
Are they all post-millennial?
They're all post-millennial.
Right. That's a problem.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Millennialism is a problem.
It's like the final Roman Emperor idea.
Exactly, right. And one of the key components of Dominion theology is this idea that Christians need to have unity at all costs.
Take over the whole world.
Unity at all costs. And we talked about this on Skywatch TV.
Pope Francis's argument as well, right?
Yeah, and why he's going to be part of that event coming up July 16th, 17th.
Together 2016.
Where he's going to speak by video at a conference in
D.C. on the Mall.
On the Mall, there inside of Osiris's 14th
piece. Just a big inclusivist one-ism jamboree.
Yeah. But my thought is this, that these guys on both sides of this, and there are some mainstream evangelicals involved
in this,
too.
Sure, there's some really sound people that are going to be there.
Josh McDowell, Ravi Zacharias. You've got also members of this Dominionist wing of Christianity, and I think they believe that somehow they're going to direct Rome, and Rome believes they're going to pull the Protestants back under the umbrella of Rome. But the whole point is that they are all, generally speaking, post-millennial, and looking for a way to Christianize the world at the same time that the Muslims are looking to Muslimize the planet.
Right.
You're going to wind up with some kind of a confrontation there. And from this thesis and antithesis, you will get a synthesis which looks an awful lot like what we see in Revelation, the one world government.
That's my principal argument in this book,
is
that radical Islam is not the Antichrist. Baghdadi's not going to be the Antichrist.
I agree.
I don't think that. But what is Islam? Think about Sharia law. Now, think about Western values. What do we value? We value freedom, personal liberty, individualism, privacy.
Mm-hmm.
What is Sharia law? Completely the opposite.
Yeah.
Almost every single detail.
Right.
So isn't that the perfect antithesis to Western values?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about the Hegelian dialectic thesis, Western values, mm-hmm. antithesis, Sharia law.
Right.
Synthesis. Globalism.
So, and some form of religion that involves compliance. The only sin is telling somebody else that they're mistaken.
They're wrong.
Yeah.
Pluralism.
Yeah.
The whole globalist, multiculturalist, liberal shtick.
Yeah.
And that's where it's all going.
Well,
that's what Pope Francis is the epitome of.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to have to finish reading the book because I'm going to have to.
That is really the main.
Modify my outline.
That is my thesis.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's an Islamic Antichrist. I don't believe that.
No,
but I think
I agree.
He's the perfect antithesis to the thesis of what we really believe.
Well, what you're going to have is you're going to have two sides, actually three sides when you include the Jews, because
the
Jews have their own eschatology, which is going to look for...
But the thing is, they're still looking for a human Messiah the same way.
Right, right.
So all three of them are looking for one guy, a leader, a human leader, who's political, who's going to bring peace in the world.
Right.
Now, the same guy might be able to satisfy all of them somehow, and that would be the Antichrist.
my thesis is that the Muslims, frankly, are just going to be used as cannon fodder.
Probably.
They'll be used to touch off this conflict that will result in the global system.
Probably. They might get nuked. I don't know.
Because from an enemy standpoint,
they're the antithesis. They're
already lost.
Yeah.
We don't need to waste any more time.
Yeah.
Speaking as the enemy now, we don't need to waste any more time on these people. They're already lost.
I think they're antithesis.
They want to target the Christians and the Jews, the ones who have been faithful to Yahweh, more or less, and try to get as many of them. Deceive as many of them as we can.
Yeah.
I just don't see
an Islamic Antichrist because people are not going to accept Islam.
No.
Not in America.
No.
We're never going to buy that.
Most of the world. I mean, forget America.
Even the Eastern world,
the Chinese.
Can you think of one woman who would willingly become a Muslim?
you say that, but what's really bizarre is that there are American teenagers who are seeing this. It's in some romantic way that this is
really.
Yeah, I know it's
hard to believe.
Absolutely bizarre. Yeah, but,
I know.
It's not a big deal.
You want to walk 50 paces, behind your husband or 50 ahead of him in a minefield wearing a.
Yeah.
A burqa, really?
No,
I don't think so.
The book is The Final Roman Emperor, The Islamic Antichrist, and the Vatican's Last Crusade. Chris Putnam and Tom Horn are the authors, and you'll see Chris expounding on aspects of the book at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy
Absolutely.
Conference. And I will be drawing upon this now, as of today, for my presentation as well, dealing with Satan's psyops. And you can actually watch those presentations if you subscribe to the live stream. You'll find information on that at prophecywatchers.com. That's a really good deal. All 40 presentations from the 27 speakers will be streamed live.
Right.
Which means, of course,
you can go back and watch them again, right?
Well, you couldn't have to because a lot of those presentations are happening simultaneously. So unless you're doing a split screen thing, and I don't know how you wire up two computers each feeding it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll be archived for 6 weeks afterwards. You got plenty of time to go back and watch.
So you can go back and watch everything.
Right.
Yeah. And just one last thing about the book. I mean, there's a lot of books that cover some of the same information, and you know, I cite many of them, but I think we've done something unique by compiling it all into the package that we have, and we connect it with our past work. And it really does wrap right back around to what Tom Horn has been talking about with Polyon Rising, 2012, Zenith, 2016, because this final Roman Emperor prophecy actually stems from the pagan Sibyl, idea.
Sibyl.
It goes right back to the same source. It's really odd.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that until I'm not going to end this book. Just like, and it just fell in my lap. But, we think we have something unique to offer in this, and it really is that, you know, a lot of people are addressing radical Islam. A lot of people are talking about ISIS. A lot of people are talking about, you know, Armageddon and all these ideas. But the way that I parse history, and you know, I've studied history, and I knew a little bit about what I'm talking about with that. But the thing that's unique is that we try to take an immortal perspective. That's what our book On the Path of the Immortals is about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Apostle Paul wrote, you know, we don't fight against flesh and blood. And you guys use that at PID all the time. You know, our real battle is against powers and principalities with spiritual wickedness. And these are beings that don't die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in one human lifetime, you don't even notice their strategy. Okay. They're playing this stuff out over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Their strategy plays out long play. So I'm taking a long play perspective and looking at how a strategy might have been developing since 600 with Islam to today to lead us to globalism. Okay. So it's a little different because I have a supernatural worldview, and most of the authors out there writing about Islam aren't thinking that way. Okay. And so when I'm looking at prophecy and I'm looking at Islam, I'm saying, how would the powers and principalities use this to lead us to the fulfillment of their guy showing up?
Right.
So I'm taking a long play perspective is what I call it, you know, quote, how might this play out? And I see it as a really driving us to globalism is the big picture.
Yeah. And again, I just think it's astonishing that guys who are supposed to be expert in this in the Pentagon, like the fellow who was in charge of CENTCOM, General Nagata, in December of 2015, saying, actually calling together a think tank, assembling a conference of university professors, but not just in Islam. He was calling on marketing experts and gurus to try to figure out the Islamic State's marketing and its appeal.
Well,
we can't understand why these guys are so popular. It's a religious thing. It's a supernatural thing. There is no natural. It doesn't have anything to do with a branding.
It's somewhat of
the Islamic State.
Somewhat, but yeah.
But it's
supernatural.
It is supernatural. Unless you understand that, you're not going to get it.
But the Islamic State has done a masterful job of using Facebook, Twitter, and all those things. But yeah, it's not just that.
It's more than just their social media skills.
Right.
Again, the book, The Final Roman Emperor, The Islamic Antichrist and the Vatican's Last Crusade, 1995 for the book. And you also get the DVD, the data DVD with a lot of the research information.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these sources I'm talking about are on there.
Yeah. So you get that, and you also get the five interviews that were done on Skywatch TV, which included three with Tom and Chris. In fact, the first interview, I just checked the stats this morning, just the Roku plays alone, over 100,000 views over the last 3 weeks. So,
awesome.
So you'll get all of those as part of the package, and you'll find that at SkywatchTVStore.com. That's the place to get it, SkywatchTVStore.com. Chris, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
I appreciate it. And we thank you for listening. Again, we're trying something new on View from the Bunker. You see a little bit of video down in the corner. And going forward, we'll try to do more video interviews, Skype to Skype, so that we can give you a little more visual interest if you choose to watch these on YouTube. But again, the audio will still be made available the usual place. Subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find podcasts. Appreciate your patience with the somewhat spotty schedule of late between the work for Skywatch TV and trying to prepare for this conference. And as you can tell, I've been struggling a bit to get my head around it. My main problem is not so much trying to find things to talk about. It's what my dad used to say. You ask Derek the time he tells you how to build a watch. And I was actually going back to prehistoric times and starting with the sundial. So that is kind of where I'm coming from, trying to weed it down to 45 minutes, you know, showing you the forest instead of trying to pick out individual trees. But there is a book that'll come out of the presentation with the working title, The Great Inception. So hopefully we'll get that done by the end of the year. But anyway, that's kind of impacting my ability to do these interviews for A View from the Bunker on a regular basis. Don't forget the Gilbert House Fellowship. Every Sunday morning, we do 2 hours on New and Old Testament. Sharon and I are reading through the Bible in chronological order, the order in which the events recorded occurred, which means we're skipping back and forth in the New Testament between the various Gospels. The Old Testament, we're skipping back and forth between the Psalms and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. And it gives an interesting perspective and a look at the Scripture when you're hearing the Psalms that David was compiling at the time he was, say, running away from Absalom, stuff like that. So you'll see that that you'll get those every Sunday morning, usually posted by the middle of the day. That is posted at gilberthouse.org. And again, you can subscribe to that through iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you grab podcasts. And we appreciate you taking the time to leave a review for A View from the Bunker on iTunes or Stitcher. And, of course, we discuss all of the topics that we discuss here on the program at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Special thanks to Jake from seek4truth.tk, that's seek4truth.tk, for the video template, and I encourage you to watch his program as well. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.